What's up, guys? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interviewed endurance coach and entrepreneur Nate Helming. Nate has worked with some Olympic caliber as well as games athletes on their endurance training, as well as thousands of average Joes. We talk a lot about running, obviously, injury prevention, and productivity, and more. Before we get started, if you're interested in training programs, videos, blog posts, go to our website, sign up for the newsletter at brutestrengthtraining.com. Enjoy the show. All right, what's up, everyone? I'm here with Nate Helming of San Francisco CrossFit and the Run Experience, as well as several other endeavors. Nate, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, Michael. Doing well.
Thank you so much for making time for me right after you get back from your vacation. I know you're probably easing back into it, but I appreciate you making time for me, man.
Of course. Happy to be here.
So can we start out by just telling everyone a little bit about your background and maybe some of the beliefs that you had when you first found San Francisco CrossFit?
Yeah, you know, I have kind of an interesting story going into that gym. You know, when I started, I thought CrossFit was probably the dumbest thing on the planet, and I had no interest in it whatsoever. At the time, I was a competitive triathlete, and I was, you know, trying to work my way towards racing at the professional level. San Francisco CrossFit at the time was in a parking lot behind this like bike shop and sporting goods store called Sports Basement. And at the time, I was trying to race and compete, and I was working in that store. So it's really funny that I was working in the place where this gym just happened to be.
Right.
And I would rinse wetsuits because we would rent wetsuits for triathletes. That was my job. I would rinse wetsuits outside the back door, and I would stare at these guys doing all this crazy stuff in the parking lot, and I would sort of just shake my head.
Judge like, them a little bit.
Oh, totally judge them a lot of it. But what's interesting was I succumbed to this little hamstring injury, and it was a couple months before, in essence, you know, my version of the CrossFit Games, which was the Kona Ironman World Championships. I'd qualified early, and I was training up for that race. And I had this, you know, weird little achy hamstring that at first just bothered me when I would do, you know, some faster runs or what I would call like a quality run. And I was like, okay, let me go see my massage therapist. Let me talk to my coach. Let me go see a physical therapist. You know, I was plugged in the endurance world. I had excellent resources, or so I thought. And, you know, basically the weeks and months kept going by, and my hamstring was just getting worse and worse. And it basically got to the point where I had consulted with the best orthopedic surgeons in San Francisco. I had, you know, worked with some of the best massage therapists out there. I'd been going to physical therapy. You know, I was told that, you know, my transverse abdominis wasn't very strong, and because I was a runner and triathlete, my glute medius wasn't very strong. So I was doing all these, you know, little banded sidesteps and, you know, Swiss ball exercises.
Clamshells. Lots of clamshells.
Oh, man. And I joked at the end, like, I had glute meds of steel, but it still was not translating to my race. And, you know, my expectations kept changing for the race itself. At first, I was like, oh, man, I qualified for this. I'm going to show the triathlon world, like, Nate Helming has arrived. I'm just going to totally kill it my first time. And then with this hamstring, it got to the point where it's like, oh, man, you know what? This is just a learning year anyway. Just go in, put your head down, and you'll be able to limp your way through the full Ironman, which is, you know, a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and a 26.2-mile run. So on a good day, this is like a 9 or 10 hour event. So it's hard to sort of limp your way through unprepared. Mm-hmm. And basically it got to the point where I was like, oh, well, maybe I can't do the whole event. I'll go out there and maybe I'll just do the swim and the bike. And then it was like, maybe I'll just do the swim. And then basically there I am with my entire family, sitting on the sidelines, watching the race and all the participants that I should be in.
Oh no.
So I was pretty depressed. And what's worse, it got to the point where I was like limping when I was walking around because my hamstring was just was bothering me. And I was like this guy who could do all these incredible endurance things. And then it got to the point where it's like, hey, if we're parking for a restaurant, can we make sure we park at least a block away? Because any further away, I don't know if I can walk there.
No shit.
Yeah, it was bad. So I came back from Hawaii, and this was supposed to be this big celebratory end of year thing, and I was just depressed. And I went back to go see Julie, my physical therapist, and you know, I was seeing her on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 9:30 for forever. And we're just starting to go, and she's like, "I'm sorry, Nate, like we haven't made it, and you know, but I'm sure we're there. We just got to keep on going. But we have a problem." And I'm like, "Well, what's the problem?" And she's like, "Well, see, the thing is you've run out of insurance visits for physical therapy. So if you want to keep coming, you're going to have to start paying out of pocket." And at the time I was like this, you know, broke 23, 24 year old. And I was like, no way. It was like, I'm done. So I walked away. And, you know, this is where, you know, my introduction with CrossFit came in. I started to work with this coach, this trainer, this guy named Alex Margolin, and we used to do some bike rides together, and he was a friend of my coach. And he basically pulled me aside one day, and he's like, "Nate, okay, so the race is over." And I'm like, "Yes." And, you know, "You've really tried everything out there." I'm like, "Yes." And he's like, "And nothing has worked." And I'm like, "Also correct." He's like, "So really, we're in a nothing to lose scenario." And I'm like, "I guess not." He's like, "Well, do you want to try something with me?" And little did I know at the time, he was just starting to experiment with CrossFit a little bit. And, you know, one of the first moves he tried to teach me was a deadlift. And like, Michael, I was such a mess. You know, I'm, you know, just over 6 foot. Right now I weigh about 175 pounds. But at the time, I probably weighed a little over 150. So I was 25 pounds lighter. I would like blow away in a breeze, mm-hmm. is what I would choke up on the bike. And I couldn't deadlift 60 pounds. Like, I was a mess. And it took him, and I kind of joke, like, you know, it took him a couple weeks just to teach me, partly because he was new at teaching deadlifts and also part because I was such a mess. But what was interesting, as soon as I like had this moment of connecting the deadlift, it was like someone had like flicked on like the power back on in the household. And all of a sudden, I'm like, there's the rest of my hamstring. It doesn't hurt. I can walk. I'm not limping. And I had this like amazing sort of like light bulb moment where this one move, you know, all of a sudden totally changed everything. And, you know, it took a couple months to build my way back out. And then basically he says like, "Look, you got to start training with these guys in this parking lot." And that's how I got introduced to Kelly Starrett and all those guys. But I was amazed that as an athlete who had been in the know in the endurance world for so long, that no one had taught me how to do something like a deadlift or something like a squat. Mm-hmm. You know, so my first reaction when I got better, Michael, was like, I was angry. I was right. Like, wait a minute, I had done all this stuff that you guys told me to do, and how did this not work? You know, I was kind of blown away. And I was still very nervous and very scared about going into this gym. You know, I'm basically working out with guys like three times my size. You know, every single woman was stronger than me to a crazy degree.
Right.
But I had this experience where I literally had exhausted every other alternative and nothing else worked. So I was reluctantly showing up at CrossFit.
Right. And then by actually practicing the movement, you could feel it for yourself rather than someone just telling you that it's so, right?
Yeah. You know, I kind of realized that, you know, and I've thought about this since a lot. And I think, you know, there's been in the fitness and strength and conditioning world, you know, bodybuilding has such an incredible influence on, you know, how the fitness world, you know, trains and does things. And I think there's a certain sexiness in the endurance world of really understanding anatomy and knowing what muscle fires when and does what. And you still hear this with endurance athletes that they're quote unquote unbalanced or that they need to do VMO strengthening exercises, you know, that teardrop part of your quad, you know, right inside your knee. And so you're going to like take a little ball and you're going to like squeeze your knees together to strengthen. And those aren't necessarily bad exercises, but they're accessory movements at the end of the day. And what I was missing and lacking was basic skill and know-how and movement on how to just move my body. Mm-hmm. So it becomes so specific because, again, that was another message I was being told. You know, I realized, like, I grew up on the East Coast and I did a bunch of different sports. I used to downhill ski. I used to mountain bike a lot. I would go on a lot of hiking. I'd telemark ski. I would sail. I did all of these sports that in a lot of ways I realized kind of covered all the physical bases that I needed just to be a general athletic kid. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I started going down the triathlon route, you know, specificity was king. And it's like, no, to be the best athlete, you need to be more specific. So it got to the point where I was running and triathloning so much. It's like, you know what? Maybe you shouldn't ski this weekend. Maybe you should just ride your bike and run. And then it's like, you know, maybe, you know, you shouldn't help move your friend's couch because you're pretty tired and you're not that coordinated. So all of a sudden, you know, this identity as a runner and as a triathlete was this very empowering thing. Mm-hmm. Where I could do so much and go so far. But then on the back end, it became a very limiting thing. I'm a runner, so I can't.
Right.
Wow. I'm a triathlete, so I can't lift. It's not expected of me to do that. And what I realized was like, my goodness, the standards on movement and strength and athleticism in the endurance world is so incredibly low. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how many specialists there are listening to this, but I just think it's a really interesting topic that you're talking about. To be the best athlete you could be for as an endurance athlete, and this goes for many, many other sports, if not every other sport, where specificity is king. How did the GPP specifically, right, CrossFit specifically, retrain you, and then how did it like inspire you to go on and start your own company to teach others the same thing?
You know, I think I was being told for so long that I couldn't do these things. And, you know, a classic thing in the endurance world is, you know, if you're going to lift weights, it's going to be, you know, like single leg deadlifts and, you know, clamshells. You only do it in the off season. And, you know, there's some progressive coaches who are saying, well, yeah, maybe you'll include some of this in the on season. But no one was saying lift heavy weights. And I actually remember I had this moment where I had, you know, I was at the time, I weighed a little bit more, 160. And in class, I had pulled 275. As a high end endurance athlete, I was pretty proud of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically being told by every endurance athlete that that's the worst thing to do in the middle of your season and that will destroy your legs and make you tired. I basically pulled 275 on a Thursday and I rode all my teammates off my wheel on a Saturday.
Wow.
And one of the things I realized was like, wait a minute, I'm tapping into a different energy system here. You know, like that hormonal boost that I was getting, that anabolic effect from that heavy lifting, not a lot of volume, right? Just a few singles, all of a sudden was helping me recover faster from my endurance stuff. So I was like, wait a minute, there's got to be a little bit more to the picture. And not everyone who's an expert maybe knows everything here. So it gave me some room to explore and find what felt intuitively good. And, you know, fast forward, I started working with, you know, Kelly Starrett, and he invited me to be a coach there. I started traveling a lot with Carl Paoli of Freestyle Connections, and I was really fascinated with their conversations around movement and this bigger picture sense of, you know, CrossFit was this, and this is something that Kelly says too. I know he was on the podcast a little while back, is just such an incredible platform to challenge our body's athleticism and range of motion, and further to show you where you're weak and where you're not very strong. So it wasn't a mystery anymore. Like if you were limited in range of motion or strength and coordination in some place, you could see it pretty quickly.
Right.
And by doing these movements, you know, I noticed that I had significant chinks in the armor and that the entire endurance community has significant chinks in the armor. And so by learning how to do that and experiment on myself and on a few athletes I was working with, I started to see some pretty powerful effects, and I was like, oh man, we are onto something here.
Right. I was, I had the opportunity of training the Southern Utah, track team, and the distance runners were hilarious. They, cause they had never strength trained at all before, and they were so reluctant to do any of it. But as soon as we got them doing some deadlifts, some heavy squats, like you said, like as soon as they started doing those, they knew for themselves the effect.
Yeah, they could totally start to feel it. You know, and it was amazing. And sometimes the argument is like, oh, you know, as a runner, if you weigh 1 pound more, that's going to slow you down, you know, 1 second per mile in your marathon, and that's going to add up to X amount of time. So it becomes like a weight, you know, argument, and you know, they're so afraid of weighing more because they feel like that will detrimentally affect their performance. But that conversation, it's sort of like the same logic as, you know, oh, it's just about the amount of calories that you eat from a nutrition standpoint.
Mm-hmm. They're just not looking at the whole picture.
Yeah, and it's not just about how many calories you eat. It's more, and obviously I know some things on nutrition, by no means am I the nutrition expert, but you know that it's the quality of what those calories are. So from a weight standpoint, you know, I gained 10 pounds and I was training and racing and competing at a level that I was never able to do before.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it was a really interesting thing to gain weight and perform better, like climb better on a mountain on a bike, which seems totally crazy.
Right.
You know, to run faster and everything. So that feeling was so big. And it was interesting that you brought up that they felt the difference, because you realize, like, why have, you know, like what really wins people over? It's not always the logical argument. The logical argument comes in afterwards, right? But the logical argument almost justifies that feeling and that experience. But if that feeling and experience isn't there, they're not going to listen to what the logical argument is.
Right. So I have some kind of technical questions for you. And I know, or I think most of your job and your business deals with runners, right? And mm-hmm. and introducing them to strength training, GPP, et cetera. But do you ever have CrossFitters coming to you and saying, hey, I want to build an engine?
I do. I've worked with CrossFitters in the past with their running. You know, it's interesting. If CrossFitters paid as much attention and care and how they built up to, you know, their heavy squat or their heavy Olympic lift as they did to their running, I mean, I think we would see the entire CrossFit community running on an entire level, different level. So one of the things that I always find is honestly like the motivation. You know, most CrossFitters I haven't seen, in all honesty, that motivated to improve their running.
Why is that? Why do you think that is?
I think because potentially the gains take a little bit longer. You know, it's sometimes it feels, I think also just from a logistical standpoint at most gyms, you know, when a coach sends a class out to run, you know, the coach is not giving them the same feedback on the running as they are inside on the barbell, you know, and then the music's inside, the music's not outside, you know, like it's so they just kind of go outside and they sort of suffer, you know, anonymously in the dark if it's like 5:30 in the morning and they just sort of trudge their way through. But it's like, imagine if we were to flip that around where all of a sudden the coach stood outside and paid attention to everything you're doing and, you know, had the timer out and everything else. I think that, you know, if I really think about it, what makes us improve the most is probably being in the right culture and community and group. Mm-hmm. I don't think it comes down to any one magical drill. It's just like getting enough people fired up to do this whole thing together. And right. I think CrossFit has done such a good job with so many things there. And I think there are pockets of CrossFit gyms and places where running gets that treatment. But I sort of feel like within the CrossFit space, people don't get as excited about that right. as they do about the other movements.
Well, it's hard to put a 5K run in an Instagram video as opposed to a one rep max snatch or a few muscle ups, things like that. So it's not as sexy, and it's also it's a lot more painful, and there's just nowhere to hide. And people love to do Metcons, but you can hide behind technical movements and stuff like that. Whereas running, rowing, bike, you just can't hide, right? It's the same thing over and over and over. You're stuck in your own head, and you just have to get the work done. And it's the people that take it, that really want to improve their performance the most, are the ones that are taking it really seriously now. And you're starting to see all of the people at the very top having an endurance coach, at least one. Maybe they have a running, swimming, and bike coach nowadays. But those people are taking it a lot more seriously, and because of that, I think we're going to see the entire community start to seek out experts like yourself, Chris, et cetera.
Yeah, Chris Henshaw you're referring to, yeah. Who's, I think, doing a fantastic job. And one of the reasons why is because he's the coach who's actually going to stand on the track with you with the stopwatch.
Right.
And you know what I mean?
And he'll run with you.
And he'll run with you. And this is not at all to discount his incredible experience and knowledge as a coach, but I honestly don't think that knowledge and experience would translate to runners if he wasn't out there running with them. Yeah. And I think that shared community and experience is so powerful. You know, as an endurance athlete, because I still run a strength and conditioning program out of San Francisco CrossFit for endurance and cycling groups and running teams. I've worked with, you know, some local professional athletes, professional runners and ultra runners. Actually, one of the marathoners I just worked with ran a 2:21 marathon in Australia. He's trying to qualify for the Olympic team for, I want to say, El Salvador.
Oh shit. Cool.
I may get that wrong. Yeah. So he's coming in the gym and lifting and working, and it's so much fun to be a bridge to that community and to sort of help them out. Mm-hmm. But what I realized in my own training was that if I were to incorporate, you know, like I used to do this, it was a really simple but painful workout. It'd be like 5 rounds. I started at 20 reps and built to 30 reps, like 30 wall balls, 30 box jumps, and run 400 meter. I'd do that 5 times. Mm-hmm. You probably look at it and you're like, gross. And what it would immediately do is transport me to the end of my marathon or the end of my, you know, half Ironman triathlon. And it would feel so terrible, but that's why it was so effective. Mm-hmm. The problem, I think, with a lot of CrossFitters is that running feels terrible when you've done so much work. So every time they run, it's in the context of it never feeling good. And in a way, it's so powerful for endurance athletes who are already bought in because they need that level of training and they want to grit it out. Mm-hmm. But it's like, oh man, if my only experiences of running was after a lot of squats or a lot of this, and it always felt like junk, it's like, yeah, I'm probably not going to be too motivated to, sure. to run that much.
It's like a punishment every time.
Every time.
It's just like a something to do in between the fun movements, right? To get you more tired. That's how I think a lot of people think of it. What do you think? Is it necessary for an open level athlete to run? And what are like the pros and cons of running for just an open athlete?
For, you know, the CrossFit Open, you know, I think that, you know, something like running is it doesn't have to be a lot. I think that for an open athlete, even one time a week of focused running would be great. I think the most athletes are still lacking that engine development, that ability to just go at a high output for a long period of time. And as you said, you can sort of hide behind technical movements, and even in a, you know, a third, even in like a workout like Cindy or, you know, a longer 20 or 30 minute AMRAP, you know, there are breaks as you transition from one movement to the next and to the next. So it is very different when you're doing some, you know, whatever the geeked out term monostructural movement is. As you said, there's nowhere to hide. I think doing that just builds your mental ability to suffer, to focus on one thing. But also it's like, we need the reps. You know, what's interesting with, like, let's say squatting, it's like when you squat and you're going for a one rep max or a three rep max, you know, the focus is on that one singular lift that you do. That's that major moment. But if you really think about what improves your squatting, it's volume. Because how much squatting do you do to warm yourself up to that big number? Mm-hmm. You know, like the heavier squatter you are, the more squatting you need to do to warm up to get there, you know, to 400 or 500 pounds. And then a lot of times you do back off sets afterwards. So there's this magical thing about volume when you have the right mechanics and the volume is there, that good things start to happen. And I think, you know, running one or twice a week on a day where you haven't done all these other terrible things, and maybe you find a nice trail, you run with someone who is not a geeked out CrossFitter, and maybe they're a geeked out runner or triathlete instead, you just get a different look at the athletic world, can be really refreshing.
What do you think, what's the lowest hanging fruit? Like, if you only have one or two days a week, how should these people be running? I mean, do they want to build in volume up to, you know, a half marathon, or do they want to do short sprints or lactate threshold training? Where should they focus their time and effort?
The lowest hanging fruit is that they go from nothing to something. So basically, the things that I've actually helped some CrossFitters do is like, hey, let's put together, because your training output is a lot and you're working with your coach, and I want to create something that has minimal disruption to the rest of your training. Mm-hmm. So let's put together a 10-15 minute run focused warm up and little mini workout that you can use to tack on before or at the end of your CrossFit workouts, or you could extend a little bit on another day. And the same way that every CrossFit class has some sort of structure, right? Most of the time, before you even touch a heavy weight, there's going to be some sort of full body dynamic warm up. You're going to warm up that midline a little bit. Then you're going to go hit your lift. Maybe there's going to be one or two drills. Then you sort of have your main set. I like to apply that same structure to your run, even if it's 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Short warm up. You're going to stop and, you know, do some leg swings, do some inchworm push-ups, do some, you know, long lunge hip circles. Maybe add one running drill in there. And, you know, I've got so many videos on that. It almost doesn't matter, you know, but just to bring a little intention. And then, you know, you could go off and do 5 to 10 minutes easy. You could do a little fartlek style intervals, like you could outside, you could do a Tabata style interval where you run at a faster pace for 20 seconds and you either walk or jog for 10 seconds. If you were to do that consistently over time, that would be enormous.
And is that, how would it be enormous? What is actually taking place physiologically?
I think you are able to, with that level of consistency and not necessarily overdoing it, you are just like, you're building that tendon and ligament strength to be able to handle that pounding consistently. Mm-hmm. You are obviously building, you know, like with such an emphasis on you know, higher intensity. And even in the world of CrossFit endurance, they say that there are aerobic benefits to doing things at high intensity. Like, there's still a lot of benefits to be had by doing low intensity stuff, you know? So
tons.
So like giving your body that opportunity to do some low intensity stuff is fantastic. Helping you recover from some of your stuff, not only physiologically, but mentally as well. Mm-hmm. And just being outside and being able to enjoy it. The other thing I found with running is it's a great place to work on and developing your ability to breathe well.
Right. If you're a chest breather, you're going to have a hard time with running.
You are. And you know, I think one of the reasons I think we a lot of athletes, especially a lot of open athletes, you know, they're chest breathing and they're stressed out like crazy and they don't even realize it. But everything is hard and things are fast and you're just swinging all these weights around, so it doesn't matter. You know, it's funny, even in like of a burpee, you know, when I'm working with athletes, you can see that at a moment when they kind of hit the ground, right before they hit the ground, there's just a moment where they tense up and they hold their breath as opposed to being able to breathe smoothly through. Mm-hmm. So one of my actually favorite, most like effective run workouts out there is the nose breathing mile.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, can you run 1 mile only through your nose? And in the beginning, my coach, yeah. it doesn't have to be fast. Mm-hmm. Like walk that sucker, go slow, you know. And if you are experienced, if it's not your first rodeo, hey, what's the fastest nose breathing mile you can do mm-hmm. to really prime wow. and challenge the diaphragm?
God, I love that shit.
Yeah, and you know, I do that with the run experience because right now we have probably about 3,000 runners worldwide in our programs. So I'm always looking for things that develop and deliver that feel and that experience. Like I could talk about the benefits of belly breathing all along and they might be like, yeah, whatever. But if I have them say, hey, go and try this thing for a mile, you know, it's right in front of their face real quick. And they're like, right. wait a minute, what is this?
That's
I suck
cool.
at this. What is this? And it's safe. No one's going to hurt themselves doing that. The worst thing that happens is you start breathing through your mouth.
Right.
And it starts to have that conversation, you know, with their diaphragm, which is missing. Mm-hmm. So I find that if you can belly breathe there, all of a sudden that diaphragm is activated. That's actually what helps you stabilize your hips when you run to prevent any collapse at the hip, knee, and ankle, which is such an important thing for runners. But, you know, for CrossFitters in and out of longer Metcons, and even being able to breathe and stabilize doing like high volume thrusters or power cleans or anything else.
Right. So I completely agree with you, especially in the building of ligaments and tendons. If I think the highest yield thing for CrossFitters in terms of endurance training is that longer duration stuff, like 30 to 90 minute time period. And you definitely have to work your way up to doing that. You shouldn't just go from running zero to running 60 minutes twice a week even. You'll probably get injured, but if you can work your way up to where that doesn't hurt you at all a couple days after, for me and as well as athletes that I've trained, I see the biggest improvements by just increasing their aerobic capacity through those longer runs. Their recovery becomes a lot faster. Their recovery in between events becomes a lot faster.
For sure.
All that kind of stuff. And then in workouts, they just feel like they just have a bigger engine. They can breathe better. The work is more effortless is what we hear a lot. But you really cannot replicate running with something like rowing or aerodyne. It's a totally different beast.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique thing. You know, what's interesting is that, and granted, this isn't an issue with CrossFitters, but when you take a very talented swimmer or water polo player and you get them into triathlon, you know, their ability to obviously adapt to swimming and cycling happens faster than their ability to adapt to running. And one of the things that's interesting is because either as a cyclist or as a swimmer, you spent so much time of your athletic life non-weight-bearing, they've actually measured your bone density, and that's for some of these athletes, their bone density is significantly less. So one of their issues, but they have this incredible fitness and this incredible engine, mm-hmm. so their fitness is way exceeded their body's ability to handle that pounding.
Right.
That is so it's an interesting thing to ease their way in. And everything. It's powerful. You know, I really like taking the approach of, you know, longer extended EMOMs. You know, if you're doing a 10 or 15 or 20 minute Olympic lifting EMOM, you do a couple focused lifts a minute and then the rest of the minute is a rest. It's like, I think that's a nice way to bridge and introduce longer periods of running for CrossFitters. Mm-hmm. And with some of those longer runs, it's not just the volume that really makes them sore. It's the volume combined with bad mechanics that makes them sore.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So have you ever heard of a guy named Jeff Galloway?
I believe so.
So he's in the runners, he's in the running world, and he's a running coach. And Jeff Galloway is a guy who really pioneered the run walk method.
Okay, I'm not officially. Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay.
The idea was that, you know, especially for a lot of newer runners, you know, the idea was like, man, you know, if I'm running a 10-minute mile or 15-minute mile, it's hard to get through these things, these longer distances alone. And one of the things he says, like, hey, if you were to structure walking breaks in with your running, you can really successfully complete these longer runs. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that. And at first I kind of discounted it, you know, as an athlete, it's like, ah, I'm not going to take walking breaks. That's, you know, that's a pile of junk. But he told me that he actually trained one of his runners, you know, to go from a 2:31 marathon to like a 2:28 marathon taking walking breaks.
Wow.
I was like, wait a minute. I was like, what's what's going on here? This seems kind of crazy. And I thought about it, and it's like, wait a minute, why would you not be as sore even if you cover the same distance, right? You've got two athletes, they both run 10 miles. Mm-hmm. One athlete does it all the way through. The other athlete, you know, takes a walking break every 4 minutes. They've covered the same distance. They've done the same amount of pounding. You know, why is one athlete more sore than the other? And I sort of realized that it's like, man, it's really hard. It's hard for people to sit upright throughout the day. You know what I mean? Like as they're throughout their day, they might start upright with good posture, but towards the end, they're all slumped over looking over their phone. So if they can't do that throughout the day, under low physical stress, how are they going to do that in their runs? So I realized that with this walk-run method, it was a little pattern disrupt. It was ability to reclaim better mechanics because you gave yourself those short doses of a break. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you could prolong your running and run further more safely because, one, you were controlling the intensity. You weren't going too high, which is a problem with CrossFitters. And the other one was you had better mechanics, which is also a problem with CrossFitters.
Right.
So I was like, what if we were to introduce this with CrossFitters, and maybe as opposed to just walking breaks, they would stop and do like 10 air squats, 10 push-ups.
Right.
Nothing that would be too crazy for them. So I started to add that in with some CrossFitters, and I think they really liked that because mentally they were going to be out there for an hour, but they only had to stay focused for the next 5 or 10 minutes. And then, you know, for them, it's funny, their break was the air squats and the push-ups, and then they'd have to go and run again.
So what? Okay, so it would be 5 or 10 minutes without stopping, and then just a short 10 air squat break or something, or what?
Exactly.
What's the protocol? Okay.
Yeah. So you would basically every 5 minutes you'd run, and every 5 minutes stop and perform, and you could mix it up, right? Sometimes it could be you could do 10 lunges, you could do 10 burpees, and for certain athletes, this could be a conditioning element, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to do enough volume relative to their level of conditioning that mm-hmm. they're going to get a big fitness boost. But for like your CrossFitters who are regularly doing high volume body weight things all the time, if you were to give them 5 to 10 reps of a body weight movement, it's not a conditioning element, but what it does act is that pattern reset. It helps them reclaim, oh yeah, this is what good posture is.
Okay, so
this is better breathing, this is better shoulders. My hips are getting stiff because I'm running and I'm just kind of dragging myself through. But if I squat or I do a little lunge, I'm just reclaiming what that good hip position is.
Right. And then you go back to running and you are refocused rather than just getting kind of bored and letting your form fall, right?
Fall apart. Okay. Exactly.
Gotcha. That makes great sense. Let's see. I want to talk about shoes very briefly, like what the best shoe is, but whatever happened to the Five Fingers? Did that fad just fade, or is that still out there?
You know, it's funny. right now in the running world, there has been the pendulum has swung the other direction where there is a trend on these maximalist shoes.
No.
I'm serious. Oh, and you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with this. You know, the Hoka is probably the company that is like kind of the face of this thing. And it's sort of interesting to see where they went. But
this sounds like a South Park episode coming up. Minimalist versus the maximalist.
It's great. And I'll kind of walk you through it a little bit. But like, so a while ago, they had the Vibram Five Fingers. And I think they really exploded with that book, Born to Run, written by this author, Christopher McNugle, who followed this tribe in Mexico of runners and how they ran all these incredible distances barefoot. And they were this amazing thing. And his own personal story of he had dealt with so much pain and low back pain, and when he started running more barefoot, and those five fingers was basically a way to just simply protect your feet. Mm-hmm. You could go and do that. Well, of course, everyone started to do this thing, and they probably went from never having walked barefoot in their life, not very strong developed feet, to trying to do all this stuff on hard pavement in New York City. Mm-hmm. And there's probably just as much disaster as there was before. So I think it didn't stick around too long because, for certain people it worked, but for a lot of people, they jumped into it too quick.
Right.
The shoes are a little goofy looking. So I think from a fashion standpoint, we're like, all right, these are, maybe only going to be a little niche.
Right.
And then, from a practical standpoint, I had worked with some clients out here who were like, yeah, they're fun until like I snagged my big toe on like a root or a rock. And my toes weren't protected, that I was like, maybe I'll go towards another shoe.
Uh-huh.
So what was interesting about that shoe, the Vibram Five Finger, was it took this whole motion control away. Like with traditional running shoes, the idea was that we're going to control how much your foot pronates, which is that natural motion when, your arch, absorbs impact and rolls in a little bit. The biggest issue is with overpronation, and this is where people stand with their feet turned out a little bit. And maybe Kelly talked about this on your podcast, and this is why he always talks about feet straight and teaching athletes all over to kind of screw their feet into the ground a little bit to develop better posture, which develops a better, stronger arch. Mm-hmm. But they're seeing this overpronation and this total collapse of the foot. So they're like, hey, if we put something underneath your foot, that's actually going to help stabilize your foot. And that's where you started to see stability, moderate stability, motion control shoes. So what was interesting was like, hey, these shoes actually aren't helping fix people's injuries because this arch, A, is a natural shock absorber for the body so that when you remove that spring, that impact is translated elsewhere. And then the other thing is that when you take people who are pronated and you push them out too far so they're landing on the outsides of their feet, that creates a whole nother set of problems. Mm-hmm. So it became this unwieldy thing. And I think the Vibram Five Fingers came in and they're like, hey, let's not go there. Let's go back to how we naturally used to move and run. And in theory, it's correct. But in practice, we're so far removed from that level of time barefootedness, it created a lot of problems.
Gotcha. I got a quick story for you about me and Five Fingers. I ran a marathon in 2009. It was my first and only, hopefully ever, marathon. I trained really hard. I did, relatively very well. And then I was immediately burnt out on running. And I met my best friend now. I think it was him that introduced me. His name is Bryce, and he introduced me to these toe shoes called Vibram Five Fingers. He gave me the
yep.
Born to Run book. I got
there
the shoes, and I start, and that was right when he introduced me to CrossFit as well. So I start doing those shoes, and it's funny enough, I was so burnt out on running and didn't have any goals, and I started smoking cigarettes again. And pretty quickly, I was back to a pack a day, and I have a good friend, Ryan Hignall, who he recounts to me years later as remembering, and this is before we met through CrossFit, he remembers me as the kid in college. I had just started school at the University of Utah, and he remembers me as the guy that would walk in late with the Vibram Five Fingers smelling like cigarettes every day.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I know. He didn't tell me that for another 3 or 4 years. He's now
the picture
one of
health.
Exactly. I probably hung out, I hung on to them another 3 months and got rid of them and the cigarettes. Thank God. But that was, I always thought that was pretty funny.
That is funny. So, you know, so going to the Maximalist shoes, what they've basically done now is they've tried to take and keep some of the good things from the minimalist shoe trend, but just add more cushioning. So one of the things they realized was like, oh, okay, having a shoe that's a little bit wider in the front, and they were doing that with these minimalist shoes, allows for your toes to separate a little bit more and your foot kind of expands every time it hits the ground. Mm-hmm. So like, let's keep that. That's good. And then the other thing they liked from the minimalist shoe was a shoe that was more of a zero drop shoe, meaning that the heel wasn't as elevated versus mm-hmm. the forefoot. An exaggeration would be a high heel.
Right.
So they're like, oh, let's keep that too. Let's do a very, very low drop, only a few millimeters or nothing whatsoever. But they realized, hey, actually having some cushioning is not necessarily a bad thing. So I've worked with a lot of athletes who basically are like, hey, my knee hurts a lot when I run, but now I run in these shoes and it doesn't hurt anymore. And you're like, well, maybe that's just going to buy you about a year before right. you're going to have to confront that knee issue. But I also worked with some athletes who they train with me regularly. They're focused on their run technique. They're working on their strength and movement and mobility. They're on a smart progressive program. And they were like, Nate, when I run once a week in these shoes and I do my long run in these Hokas, my legs don't feel as beat up on Monday, which means I can recover faster and train hard again. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, how different are those shoes than weightlifting shoes and weight belts?
Right.
And I realized, oh, it's not at all. This is just a tool to use. Mm-hmm. But the difference with runners is that they don't, like Olympic lifters are still working on squatting mechanics and drills, et cetera, all the time. Mm-hmm. They're not assuming that the weight belt teaches them how to lift.
Right.
With the running, sometimes that there's that element there still.
It's kind of a crutch, and it hides what might the like mobility issues underneath or overuse injuries underneath that, right? And so then they don't have to look at them.
Totally.
Got it.
But how many CrossFitters do you know who will, you know, pull out their Oli shoes even if it's like a lightweight Metcon workout? And you're like, really? Like, I can understand if you need your shoes if you're going hard in the paint for your heavy clean.
Right.
But, you know, you're doing light to medium cleans with running, you're going to run in your Olympic lifting shoes.
Right,
like,
right.
You know, like, or you're going to, like, take your shoes off and put your other shoes on and go and run. And, you know, it's, I always joke, like, depending on the workouts, you know, we have athletes at our gym who are, like, they have their own socks and their jump rope and there are three different pairs of shoes depending on what they're trying to do. And you're going to see all three of them in this workout because they're trying right. to get the perfect thing. And you're like, come on, guys.
Yeah. So running is such like a mental sport, like we talked about earlier. It's just it can be monotonous and very painful and stuff like that. Do you do any work for your athletes on their mental game other than just exposing them to, like, say, CrossFit workouts?
You know, the mental aspect that I work so with a lot of my runners and triathletes, you know, the running aspect is not necessarily suffering for them. It's getting outside. It's spending time with friends. They enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You know, so that mental game and aspect isn't hard. The hard mental aspect, I think, for all athletes is, you know, continuing to do something when your body is screaming at you to stop.
Right.
You know, it's like, I can't do this anymore. This hurts. This is painful. And, you know, so basically giving them workouts that really emphasize that. So that's where like harder track workouts come in, long runs where they'll spend some time at race pace at the end when they're the most tired, mm-hmm. you know, in the CrossFit gym, giving them something disgusting to do with a barbell and a kettlebell and a medicine ball, and then having them go out and run and basically saying like, I don't care that you're tired. I don't want to see it. You know, right. like, show me what you got and right. we'll do this together. And if you're falling apart, you know, we can stop. But if you can do that in here, you can start to do this outside. Mm-hmm.
I think what something you touched on earlier is huge here as well. You talked about culture, right? So if you have a culture of people that work their ass off and they train smart, but they push through, feelings of being uncomfortable, maybe not pain, but being uncomfortable, it is so much easier to build a habit of being a mentally tough athlete when you're surrounded by other people doing the same thing.
For sure. You know, it's funny, when you work with some of your track athletes who run, the 400 meter or the 800 meter, the mile, I mean, that is so disgusting. Like, it is so painful. Like, running a mile all out or 400 meter all out, it's horrible. But for a lot of them, they're so used to that flavor of pain, it's very comfortable. You put them in a 5K or a 10K, and they're like, no way. Right. I will never do that. That's just too hard. And so with the amateur level, I work with a lot of, ultra runners and marathoners who are used to running, 3 hours, 4 hours, 10 hours, but you couldn't get them in a mile race or 5K because it hurts too much. Mm-hmm. But they'll gladly suffer at a lower level for longer periods of time for 10 hours. So it's kind of funny.
I like how you put that, their flavor of suffering.
Different flavor.
I like that a lot. man. Joe Rogan talks a lot about conquering his inner bitch, and he's always doing kettlebell workouts with that. So I think about that when I'm holding kettlebells, but now it's making me look at it a different way. Cause I'm one of those guys that hates the long stuff.
Yeah.
So now I'm maybe that's what I got to go out and do, some of the long stuff.
And getting back to like the CrossFit gym, I think that, even as members, we're all standing around when that person is attempting that heavy lift or they're trying to get that last set of muscle ups in. But what if we were to stand around when they're finishing that last 400 meter repeat? Mm-hmm. And pushing them just as much out there.
Right.
So I think that, all the elements are there. They're in place. All we just need to do is shine a light and a little focus on this. And all of a sudden we can really change that.
I love that. And I agree. That would be huge. Okay. I got a couple more, kind of different questions for you before we wrap up. You mentioned something to me, via text a while back about, just things you think about a lot and what other interests you have other than running. And you brought up the example that you like thought experiments like this. So I want to hear your take on it. Would Da Vinci have painted the Sistine Chapel if he was staring at Instagram all day, or would that have inspired him to do something greater? What do you think?
It's funny. I've been like, this is when we were talking earlier before we started recording about Instagram and how I sort of deleted it. I really enjoy Tim Ferriss's podcast. I like his guests that are on there and the questions that they ask. And what was really interesting was especially all of his creative guests and people who are writers or they're producing movies and film or music, or even from a company standpoint, they always try to divide their day into, kind of keeping up with everyone they need to keep up with, but also allotting certain periods of time of the day for what they call deep work.
Right.
And deep work, they said sometimes it's only 2 to 4 hours. I listened to an interview with Malcolm Gladwell, who's written, The Tipping Point, and I think David versus Goliath, I can't remember the name, but David Blink, all those books, about how he would try to take 2 to 4 hours of just writing and research a day, and it's like he's unplugged from everything. Mm-hmm. And, I was kind of joking with like Leonardo da Vinci. It's like this incredible well of creativity, was probably inspired by people around him and things in his life, but it also like came from within, and his life was ideally, hopefully, quiet enough that he could tap into that. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age, we have so many things shouting at us for our attention all the time. How many of us ever really tap into that well of deep thought and deep work?
Right.
So it's like, man, where does Instagram fit into our world as like creative individuals? Like, I can see different things on there, how people are doing different things, and maybe be inspired by that. So I get some outside influence, but then I'm spending there so much time on it all the time, all the day. Everyone starts copying each other. So all of a sudden I'm just like staring at the herd of like kind of the same message again and again and again. It's sort of like, I enjoy top 40 music, but it all sounds the same. Mm-hmm. You know, so for me, it's like, I don't know. I think I'm glad that he was not on Instagram.
Right. God damn, that's a great answer. Oh man, I think the idea of kind of the ebb and flow of keeping in touch and staying connected with people can be very important in this day and age, and it definitely has a lot of benefits, but there is the low-hanging fruit, if you will, is taking time to unplug, and I think that will have a much greater effect than staying as plugged in as possible for people, because like you're saying, they don't, whether it be for quote-unquote deep work or not, nothing is as rejuvenating as taking time to unplug and sit with yourself, your emotions, your thoughts, etc. So I definitely agree with you.
You know, it's funny. I think not to interrupt you, but I think there's this quote. I'm probably going to butcher it a little bit, but like basically they could, I can't remember who said this, but they said that all the problems in the world can go back to man's inability to sit in their room quietly by themselves for an hour.
Right.
They're so like, they can't sit quietly happily. So they start getting into different things, and whether that's, you know, stirring the pot, going online, or like starting a war or a revolution or whatever, you know, just from that philosophical standpoint, it's like, man, we are really not good at sitting quietly.
Right.
It's kind of crazy.
I agree. Last question for you. You're a successful athlete, coach, entrepreneur, et cetera. What tips do you have for people that want to be more productive? What kind of like rules do you set for yourself to be as productive as possible?
I limit my time on email and social media. I only look at it, you know, maybe twice a day.
For how long?
I think for this day and age, it depends. I think for some of my social media, if I'm creating posts or I'm responding to people in our programs, I'll spend a concentrated 30 to 45 minutes to an hour. But what I'll do is I'll put the like do not disturb, you know, notification thing on my computer if I'm doing other work, and right. I'll set aside, you know, time to, if I'm programming, if I am filming or editing videos or anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's like, don't let yourself get caught in the trap of just feeling busy but not being productive.
Right.
And it's really easy to feel busy by looking things online and getting pulled to 30 different articles and what's happening, you know, with this, you know, celebrity and whatever, you know, and it's like, just no, like get out of that.
Right.
And then particularly if you're someone who is a coach at the gym and you want to, you know, start writing some content or producing and you're like, who am I to say anything or do anything? Well, it's one of those ironic things to develop your voice, you just have to start writing, and it's not going to happen at the gym. The gym may be a place of inspiration and fun, but you got to get out of there too.
Mm-hmm. I love that answer as well, man. One of the best things that I've ever learned for productivity is along those same lines. So I turn my phone on for 30 to 90 minutes. And I make sure to go pee, get water, whatever I need beforehand. But I turn my timer on for 30 to 90 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Turn on airplane mode. Internet's off. And I cannot leave the work area until the timer goes off, right? So I have to work continuously on whatever I'm working on and do nothing else. And I had been kind of out of rhythm with that for a while, and I was on a plane the other day, and I didn't have Wi-Fi. Obviously, I couldn't use my phone, and I crushed it. I got
that's so great.
You know what usually would have been days worth of work done in 3 hours, and it's because of being unplugged like that.
I love that.
Yeah, it's huge.
I love that. That's so powerful, and we just have to be so, you know, protective of our time these days. It's, you know, a problem, you know, we never used to have. Mm-hmm. But I think that's so great, you know, and I actually haven't gone that extreme. I just try to like exercise willpower, but maybe I'll start putting my phone on airplane mode.
Right.
I like that.
Nate, where can everybody find you and keep up with you, man?
So you can keep up with me at Nate Helming on Instagram and Twitter. I'm not super active on those, but I am at The Run Experience. So especially if you're looking for help with your running or any strength training or mobility work, and really we're going after people who are brand new runners to also creating things for like high-level CrossFitters to add more running into their program. You know, you can find us The Run Experience on Facebook, at The Run Experience on Instagram and Twitter, and The Run Experience on YouTube. And we're actually doing a cool new campaign right now. We're launching 3 videos a week for the next couple months on YouTube, which is going to definitely keep me busy. But we've already got a couple weeks up worth. We got a lot of great stuff up there, so we'd love to see
it. Nice. What kind of videos?
Oh man, everything on, you know, training tips around marathon and half marathon training, injury prevention exercises and strategies. Simple strength exercises and training you can add in. If you're a new runner, what are some things you can do to help you out?
Hell yeah, man. And it's therunningexperience.com, right? If people want to.
It's the Run Experience.
Okay, cool. Go check it out, guys. He's got a sexy website, really well done, really easy to navigate. And he's got a really nice flow chart for to find out, you know, exactly what program is right for you. I love it. I think I'm gonna steal that, dude.
That's how we met, actually.
Yep. Oh, I remember that. Were you working on that when we met?
I was working on that. Okay. And we were at this digital marketing conference, and I don't know how many people are there. There's at least 5,000 or more, and we're sitting in this huge banquet hall, and I hear this guy, this, you know, deep voice from behind me being like, dude, sweet sight. And I just turn around, and I see.
Just trying to make friends.
Just trying to make friends. And, you know, like, everyone's in a suit, and, you know, everyone looks different levels. But, you know, when you see someone who does the sport that you do, you kind of recognize them pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So I looked at him pretty quick, and I'm like, okay, I feel like, you know, this guy's probably in the CrossFit space. We just started talking from there. So that was really cool to see you also at this digital marketing thing as well, and you know, trying to get better at getting your message out to more people.
Exactly, man. Well, dude, thank you so much. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been totally great. Are you going to be down at the games?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. I will be there too.
Awesome, brother.
All right.
Talk to you soon, man.